For those of you that are in front, let me offer you an apology, because in 20 minutes is not sufficient time to do anywhere near the amount of justice and insight into the issues related to climate change and the larger dynamic of food security, which I suspect many of you will be working on in the years to come. So let me go ahead and begin by sort of giving a sense of where we are on this, giving you some background so we're all on the same page. We know where atmospheric CO2 is coming from. We know it's increasing since the start of the Industrial Revolution. This is the change from anthropogenic emissions and the overall contributions to CO2. This is the Mauna Loa data beginning in the late 1950s. Continuing on to today, we recently broke the 400 parts per million barrier. And the question I'm sure that's occurring to many of you is, so what? Why would you give a flying donut whether CO2 is 300 or 400 or 500 or 600? Who cares, right? Why does it matter? Well, it matters for a couple of reasons. One is what I would call an indirect effect having to do with surface temperatures. If you look at the atmosphere composition, you'll see that most of the atmosphere consists of nitrogen, oxygen, a bit of argon. But there are two very special global warming gases. One is CO2, the other one is water vapor. And to explain what a global warming gas actually is, I will turn, of course, to the guitar. How many of you play a musical instrument of some kind? Excellent. So my question is directed to you. If I tune two strings of a guitar to the key of A, which is 440 hertz, and I hit one string, what will the second string do? Sorry? It will resonate. What if I'm a Presbyterian? Will it still resonate? What if I'm a Republican? Will it still resonate? Are you sure? Okay, I see some doubt in your eyes there, so just double checking. That's absolutely right. It turns out the laws of physics are, in fact, independent of political affiliation and religious denomination. Who knew? What that has to do with the global warming gas, however, is this. These gases also resonate. They don't resonate in the key of A, but they resonate in the key of infrared. That is, they absorb infrared or heat coming off the Earth's surface. We've known about this for 150 years. It forms part of what we call the natural greenhouse effect. It keeps the Earth much warmer than it would be otherwise. However, you run into a Goldilocks situation where you're just right, too much or too little. And as you add more of these gases to the air, then of course you're going to change surface temperatures. Now, how will you change surface temperatures? And this is the part that most people don't quite understand. If you look at water vapor and CO2, we can look at the Earth as a whole and say, where on the Earth is it warm and humid, where water vapor is the dominant greenhouse gas and therefore adding CO2 will have less of an effect? Where would that biome be? Where would that area be on the Earth? Tropics, absolutely. So we don't expect to see much of a change in the tropics. Now let's flip that around. Where is the air dry? Doesn't hold a lot of water vapor, and therefore adding CO2 will have a disproportionate effect. Deserts, poles. It's nice to see you're all members of the Psychic Friends Network, so I know exactly what you're thinking and put up the appropriate slide. No, that's exactly right. So when we talk about averages, it's often we say that, well, the Earth's increased by 0.8 degrees Celsius, but that really hides what is in fact happening, is that you're seeing this very different effect in terms of surface temperatures around on the surface. And of course, that difference in surface temperatures is likely to, in turn, cause greater storm severity. So the thing to remember is that if water vapor is high, it's the dominant warming gas, and there's little effect of CO2, and if water vapor is low, adding CO2 will increase the surface temperature, and that differential rate of warming is likely to drive extreme events. And this is just some examples taken from NOAA, tropical storms and major hurricanes in the North Atlantic. I can show you ones from the Pacific for typhoons, et cetera. It's not the number that's in fact changing pretty much as it is the change in storm severity. This is an old, for some reason, it came up with the old version here. I'm not sure which version I sent you. So anyway, we'll continue. The other effect of rising CO2, which is important, is that CO2, of course, is the source of carbon for all life. If you add CO2 with light, nutrients, and water, you get food. And that's what drives all of biology. So it's fair to say that as CO2 rises, and given what we know about plant biology in the sense that 95% of all plant species don't have enough CO2, that that's going to differentially affect plant biology of and by itself. So if in fact you change the amount of CO2, much as you would change the amount of water or the amount of nitrogen globally, you're going to in fact affect plant biology. And since plant biology is the basis of the food chain, you're affecting every single aspect of how life on the planet exists. That's separate from anything you may have heard or read about climate change. Well, is this change, for lack of a better word, a good thing? Well, it can be, except that CO2 doesn't distinguish between what a good, quote-unquote, plant is and what a bad, quote-unquote, plant is. It's just not a very smart molecule. So, in fact, it can not only affect the rates of growth of, say, lettuce or pine trees, but can also affect the rates of growth of something like poison ivy. In fact, it induces poison ivy to produce a more virulent form of urushiol, which is the oil in poison ivy that causes contact dermatitis. So the question then becomes, how will CO2 and climate change alter weed impacts? Well, I don't know either because I can't get my slides to advance. Here we go. Well, there is kudzu. Some of you may be familiar with that, which responds very nicely to CO2, by the way. And here's sort of a synopsis of looking at how rising CO2 will affect invasive species. So it isn't just a question of when you change CO2 that you're going to change a plant species. You, in effect, are affecting every single plant species within a plant community. Because as when you change a resource, whether the resource is water or nutrients or CO2, different plant species respond differently to that change. So in a synopsis of all the literature that's out there in regards to how CO2 affects plant communities, what we find is that in the half dozen or so studies that have been done, it is in fact the invasive species that becomes more dominant when more CO2 is given. It's a small sample, but it's not a very encouraging sign in terms of biodiversity or the impact of invasives. This all examines future CO2 values. So, yeah, it's a nice study. It's all kind of theoretical. Maybe my grandchildren will worry about it. It's not really something that we have to worry about. Well, let's look at this a little more practically. How will CO2 and climate alter weed biology right now? To address that, we actually have to ask a basic question. Why do you suppose they started monitoring CO2 at 10,000 feet in Mauna Loa? Hula girls? Mai Tais? Timeshares? Why did they choose this high elevation in Hawaii to monitor CO2? Any ideas?
Away from
That's right, made from people who are producing CO2. If I walk out now to Canal Street, do you think the CO2 concentration in Canal Street is going to be the same as it is in Mauna Loa? No. In fact, CO2 is already different on the planet's surface. Can we exploit that difference? And that's what we tried to do. We tried to do it in real time. What we said was, look, all that related to background CO2 and temperature is fine, but we already are seeing what will happen with climate change in terms of CO2 and temperature with urbanization. In a city, we already have a heat island effect. In a city, we already are seeing more carbon dioxide. So can we use cities as a surrogate for determining how weed biology might change? So we did this. We took truckloads of soil, 2 meters by 2 meters by 1 meter deep plots that we put out. We put the same seed bank that came from a single source on the farm, had about 40 to 50 different plant species in it, including some invasives. And we put it out at each of these sites. We watered the sites. We made sure the sites were as uniform in terms of the physical properties as possible, and we monitored them over time. And if you look at the monitoring, it pretty much shows what we hadn't expected. That is that the CO2, daytime CO2, was higher as you went into the city of Baltimore, which is our city. I didn't mean to pick Baltimore. I just happened to live there. Daytime temperatures are warmer. Nighttime temperatures are warmer. The growing season is longer. In other words, it's not a bad surrogate for understanding how the climate change that you anticipate 50 years from now is already occurring today. Well, okay, but could other things be changing? Well, one of the things we were most concerned about was ozone, because we know ozone affects plants. But what we found was that when an ozone event occurred in the city, an urban area, in fact, it occurred throughout the transect almost the same time, within hours of each other. And that difference wasn't enough for it to be a differential effect in terms of that transect. The one effect we did see was that there was more nitrogen being deposited in the urban area, but it was relatively small relative to the amount of nitrogen in the soils that we brought out. So we didn't pay too much attention to that part of it. So the first year, as you can imagine, we have bare soil, lots of different seeds, and of course the first thing that had come up are weeds. In this case, lamb's quarter was about 90% of what we saw, ragweed and other things. Now, weeds are weeds, but they're also, in ecological terms, sometimes referred to as pioneer species because they're very good at colonizing disturbed areas. Well, in this case, they were very good. And here we're getting ready to harvest our lamb's quarter. We have our differential shade cloth, which mimics the red far red ratios to minimize edge effects. This is obviously at the organic, this is the organic farm site or our control. And by God, we were getting 6 to 8 foot tall lamb's quarters, which I got to tell you, as a weed scientist, is pretty damn good. I mean, you get 6 to 8 foot tall lamb's quarters, you definitely have a green thumb. Unless you're growing it in the city environment, in which case we've got 8 to 10 foot tall lamb's quarters. Our 8 to 10 foot tall lamb's quarters produce twice as much biomass. What was different about it were all the things that we expected to see with climate change. When we did the analysis, warmer temperatures, more CO2, a longer growing season resulted in greater weed biomass. Now here's the kicker. After 5 years of doing this, we had to stop the experiment. Why? Well, we were interested in looking at transitions. Whenever you have a disturbed soil, it transitions from the sort of annual pioneer species eventually to trees and the climax community. In the case of the Northeast, the climax community is somewhere along the lines of oak and poplar. That's usually what you end up with. We expected that, you know, this study might take 50 years if we could get funding for it. But we had to stop after 5 years. Here we are back again in an organic farm. Things have calmed down a little bit. We still have some weed species, but we're getting a lot, some herbaceous species, some perennials are starting to mix in now, very slowly as we expected. And this was our urban site. Very different. The trees had become so tall that we had to stop. They were shading the plots were no longer independent replicates. What was going on? Well, remember that first slide I showed you? The difference in biomass was such that when all that biomass died and went to the ground, it basically acted as a very nice mulch. All the small seeded weed species were selected against. The larger seeded perennial ones, however, were not. They're the ones that broke through the mulch and eventually became the dominant organisms within the biotype. So at the end of 5 years, what we found was that, in fact, as you change CO2, as you change temperature, as you change the growing season, it was, in fact, the weedy species, particularly the invasive species, like Norway maple, like ailanthus, that were part of the original seed bank, that, in fact, became selected for. And if you look at the overall biomass, what you found was that a good portion of that biomass was, in fact, invasive. So we would argue that climate change is already occurring. It's just occurring in urban areas. And that, in fact, those urban areas may be, in some ways, a harbinger of what may happen for the rest of the globe in terms of pest biology. So looking at kudzu, yay kudzu. It's like my quintessential favorite invasive. And here, it's also, if you, I think it had a starring role in most of the 1950s sci-fi black and white movies. It comes into the room and, never mind. You have to be familiar with it. Where was kudzu growing in 1971? These are data from Clyde Reed. This is the northern limit of kudzu. We focused on the Midwestern populations. Obviously, we know now that urban areas are sort of having their own thing. So we wanted to focus on Midwestern populations away from urban centers or mountains, changes in altitude. And we asked, are warmer winters contributing to northward migration of kudzu? Well, kudzu had been introduced several times over the course of history of North America, and we had a grad student at the University of Toronto, Heather Coyner, who looked at a number of the different populations, and we looked at this issue of tissue temperature, and that is in relation to relative conductivity, in the sense that if the temperature was low enough so that the relative conductivity approached 100%, then what that meant was that that temperature caused all the cells within the tissue to lyse, and so the relative conductivity went up and the plant died. And we determined, somewhat arbitrarily, but based on all the populations, that a temperature exposure of even one day of minus 28 degrees Celsius would kill kudzu, no matter where it was. So we looked at whether or not this minimum temperature has changed throughout the central part of the U.S., and I won't go through all the different weather stations that we examined, but that bottom line there is the minus 28 line here. And you can say with the 95% confidence interval in terms of the lowest recorded temperature occurring throughout the Midwest, that's changed. And as it's changed, kudzu has responded. This is as 2011 was the northern limit of where kudzu is now occurring in the United States. Again, this is not hypothetical. This is not your children or grandchildren. This is happening in real time. In 2011, the first populations of kudzu were found in Canada. And that's shown here. Each of these green dots represents a county that kudzu has been reported in, and you can find this on EDD maps. So we were interested in this, and perhaps Karen can appreciate it, because soybean and kudzu are both hosts for Asian soybean rust. And if you want to see how climate change is affecting where kudzu is growing, then perhaps that would give us some insight in terms of where soybean rust may also be in the future. So in terms of looking at this to date, weeds may be better able to exploit climate shifts and availability of CO2 relative to crops, and that enhanced resource adaptation can exacerbate crop losses from weeds and negatively impact ecological function of plant communities, including succession. But what about weed management? Maybe all of this is just a moot point because, hey, we have great herbicides and pesticides out there, and, hey, well, if the weeds get a little bit bigger, not a big deal. We'll just spray a little bit more, and we'll take care of the problem. Right. So this is Canada thistle. One of my favorite weeds. This is a one of the more pernicious weeds. Maybe it's pernicious too, I don't know. But it's pretty much everywhere in the Midwest, and especially in no-till situations. And the picture on the left is where we sprayed it with Roundup at the recommended dosage, and we sprayed it with Roundup at the recommended dosage on the right as well. The difference is that the one on the left was grown at ambient CO2, the one on the right was grown under elevated CO2. That's just spraying it by itself, which seems a little weird. So we also grew Canada thistle with soybean, and I won't go through all the details here. We did a three-year trial, a traditional sort of agronomic field trial, where we again sprayed with Roundup for Canada thistle populations in the field, making sure that the populations were the same to begin with. And the bottom line is that over time, under elevated CO2, Canada thistle resulted in greater and greater losses from soybean and became harder and harder to control. Why? Well, in the case of Canada thistle, it's kind of interesting. When you give Canada thistle more CO2, what happens is that additional carbon isn't equally distributed. A lot of it actually goes into root growth. And the really nasty thing about Canada thistle is that it can, in fact, regenerate from even small pieces of root tissue. So if you didn't kill all the roots originally with your Roundup or whatever herbicide you're using, in fact, it will come back. Now, can we kill Canada thistle under high CO2? We can. We had to double our rates of application. The number of applications, and we had to increase our concentration by 50%. But of course, there are costs associated with that as well. And of course, as an academic, you have to show at least one slide that nobody in the back can read. So this is my contribution to that. All it is a summary of all the different experiments that have looked at how rising CO2 per se can affect herbicide efficacy. And in the majority of those, it declines. I'm going to run out of time. I'll just briefly skip through this. We did a separate set of trials looking at Clearfield rice, which is a chemical mutant for imazoquin. And there, right now, there's a small amount of outcrossing between red rice and cultivated rice. And basically, the amount of that outcrossing increased when we grew these under higher CO2. Percent outcrossing increase is shown in the bottom. We grew it against a weedy red rice line called Stuttgart, and that percent outcrossing actually came from the Stuttgart to the Clearfield. But the end result was that any Clearfield plant that got genes from Stuttgart basically became a wild plant again. So, and by becoming a wild plant, it loses its ability to be controlled by a imazapyr. And there are lots of different things associated with this, but the thing that was most interesting was the lag time in flowering. The reason there isn't a lot of outcrossing right now is that there's about a two-week period between when weedy rice and cultivated rice flowered at 300 parts per million CO2. That was the CO2 at the beginning of the 20th century. Now that's at current levels, it's down to about 8 days, and at 600 parts per million, that goes down to about 2 days. So there's a lot more outcrossing that goes on. Can climate-induced changes in chemical management of pests? This was a study looking at National Ag Statistical Service data for Roundup-ready soybean, which is genetically similar, grown along these states. We wanted to look at the issue of temperature, particularly minimum temperatures. And none of that came up. Right. Sorry about that. Right. Just verbally, what we found was that it's obvious to you that there's a difference in minimum temperature between soybean growing in Louisiana and soybean growing in Minnesota. However, the average yield of soybean in Minnesota and the average yield of soybean in Louisiana are no different from each other. If, in fact, rising temperatures increase pest pressures, that seems like that shouldn't happen, right? However, if you look at management, particularly if you look at chemicals applied, what you find is that for insecticides, for fungicides, for herbicides, all of that increases proportionally with minimum temperatures. In other words, as you move from Louisiana to Minnesota, the amount of pesticide in all classes diminishes. So you can get a good yield of soybean in Louisiana and Mississippi, but it takes you more chemicals in order to achieve that. And I apologize for the slides not coming up. Right, so weed management. CO2 may reduce herbicide efficacy. The basis of reduction is likely to be species specific. There's little known regarding the impact of climate and CO2 on other means of weed or pest control. Obviously, biocontrol would be one that we don't know much about. Physical control would be another one. But obviously, if something like Canada thistle puts more CO2 into the roots and you're using some kind of tillage to cut the roots up, that's probably not a good thing. Climate, CO2 are likely to alter basic aspects of pest biology, including gene transfer, fitness, and distribution. There's a lot of that we don't know yet. We have to have renewed efforts to detect weapons of mass destruction. We spent billions of dollars, trillions of dollars during the Cold War to monitor incoming weapons. I would argue that pine bark beetle has probably destroyed more acreage than any Russian ICBM, and it might not be a bad idea, I don't know, to keep track of where it is, and to, I don't know, maybe use a model to figure out how climate change is going to affect where it's going to spread. Crazy stuff. Where do we go from here? Consider this your final exam. We base our knowledge on a stable climate with rising CO2 and climate change. the past is no longer a good management tool for the future. What was growing in your backyard or in your farm 10 years ago is probably not going to be what's growing there 10 years from now. As climate and CO2 change, all aspects of weed and pest biology and their impact on natural unmanaged systems will change. Weeds are, above all, rapidly adaptable to sudden environmental change. That's what makes them weeds. That's their definition. If you start changing the environment rapidly and you have a plant that can, without breaking a sweat, sorry to use that analogy, produce 500,000 seed, each seed of which has a different distinct DNA, you couldn't ask for a better management, tool to increase the spread of those weeds than climate change. All right. So weed impacts, synergy with other pests, detection, adaptation remain research priorities. We are offering a strategy of what we call monitor, trying to keep track of the weeds and pests that we currently have, mitigate, that is to prevent them from happening in your field before they actually occur, and then manage, where we don't always rely on chemicals, but try and use an integrated pest approach. So I apologize for some of the slides, and if there is time, I'll take one or two questions. Thank you. In plant communities where there are legumes and non-legumes, what would we think would happen with climate change and or CO2? Is that the question?
Well, with competition dynamics, yes, but with climate
change. Right. In general, what we've seen of legumes is that having more CO2 can, in fact, increase the carbohydrate levels for rhizobial nitrogen fixation, so they might be at an advantage. In other cases, it is going to be dependent on other aspects of the environment, such as rainfall or drought. So it's hard to predict ahead of time what the actual outcomes will be, but certainly they will be different based on how each individual species responds to the resource change and how that responds over time in terms of selection pressure.
Comments or questions?
So I thought it was interesting how you're saying our urban areas are already experiencing this climate change or similar temperatures. I mean, they say that the urban areas are going to rapidly grow in the next 50 years. So if we think about that, I mean, is this going to have a compounding effect? And what the heck are we going to do?
So to repeat the question, looking at urban areas as a potential surrogate for climate change, the point was made that urban areas are growing in scope. And what are the implications of that in terms of pest biology? So I'm paraphrasing somewhat. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Okay. The sense that I have, and it's really more a sense than it is based on published literature, is what we have seen so far suggests that cities may be, if you'll pardon the term, incubators for a lot of pest biology. That is, we did a survey in Baltimore going to homes that had been abandoned in downtown Baltimore. And we saw a much higher percentage of invasives there than we did in the out suburban and rural areas. So we think that the urban ecology part of this should be strengthened. There should be more resources put into this and a better sense of how urban areas could potentially affect pest biology for surrounding farms from that context. It's an area that, quite frankly, is wide open, and it's an area that we hope to be able to do more in the future.
It strays a little bit from the pest side, but you had mentioned that certain weeds handle the CO2 differently, like the roots grow more than the others.
Right.
Can you briefly explain how it affects, like corn or leafy greens or fruit?
Well, the issue related to corn and some of the other tropical grasses are that they have a C4 photosynthetic pathway. And that pathway is, under current CO2 levels, already saturated. So we don't expect them to show much change other than because of the indirect effects of CO2 on stomates and water use, they may be more resistant to things like droughts. That being said, when you start looking at weed crop competition, it's often given that it's a simple C3, C4 type photosynthetic comparison. It's not. Every crop has, on average, 8 to 10 different weed species competing with it. And I think there's been this somewhat outdated idea that most of the worst weeds are C4 weeds. In fact, the worst weeds for a crop are often a simply wild relative of the crop, because they cannot be distinguished from the crop early on when weed control is most effective. And for that comparison, what we have are monoculture with one kind of genetics, and we have a wild relative which has a huge genetic range, and we're affecting the environment. In every case that we've done so far, and admittedly not a, you know, there's not a huge number of literature out there, but in every single case, it's the weeds that respond more.
Thank you.
Thank you.